Hey, welcome to the Disability Law Show. Good to have you along for the ride. John Scholes here. James Fireman is the guy with all the knowledge, and James also the guy you want to reach out to and his team. When we're not doing this hour, you can always get a hold of James, and a phone call would be just fine. If it's only for a chat, that's fine as well. 1-855-821-5900, help@disabilityrights.ca through email. Lots to get through on the show today, James, including emails. They're flying in, so we'll whittle our way through those in just a bit. But you had something off the top you want to talk about, pal. What do you got?
Well, I want to talk about a topic that has been covered to some extent in the news and that will likely have an impact on pretty much everybody that's involved in the disability space. It's the Canada Disability Benefit. So if you are unfamiliar, our federal government announced probably a year or so ago that it was planning to introduce this benefit, and it would apply to anybody who qualifies as disabled. They haven't yet defined exactly what that means. My suspicion is that the test will be something between the LTD test, disabled from your own occupation, and the test for CPP disability, the severe and prolonged, but that's yet to be defined. So it's going to require some form of verifiable disability. And the objective is to alleviate poverty in the disabled community because disproportionately those with disabilities are in poverty. That just happens far more frequently in the disabled community. That's a fact. And so it's a laudable idea, and I don't have any issue with the government trying to address that particular concern through a benefit. That's fine. The issue is how it's going to actually be enacted and how it's going to work in practice. And so one thing that we understood initially is that the benefit was going to be at least reasonably significant. We had heard something in the neighborhood of $7,000 to $15,000 per year, which is a significant amount, especially to somebody who is not working, who has no other form of income, and particularly to those who don't even have access to long-term disability.
Right.
Turns out that the maximum benefit, and the maximum would only be applicable to those who are in the greatest need, so those with the least other income, is going to be $2,400 per year or $200 per month. It's not nothing, but it's not a lot. It's not nearly what was expected. The other part of this that is troubling, although I don't know exactly yet how this is going to work, is how that money is going to be treated for two different purposes. So one is the extent to which that benefit is going to be taxable. What the government has done is said that this benefit is not going to be treated as income for the purposes of determining other benefits. So there are other government assistance programs that you may or may not qualify for if you have a certain amount of income. For those benefits, this Canada Disability Benefit will not count as income, so it wouldn't disqualify you from getting other benefits. But it says nothing about whether or not this benefit will be taxable as income, and thus what is already a pretty small benefit may become that much smaller. The other part, and this is a part that really troubles me, is that there is nothing in there yet anyway that clarifies how this can be treated by an insurance company that is paying an LTD benefit. And the reason that's really troubling is we know how long-term disability insurers are treating other government benefits, particularly CPP disability. So CPP disability is similar in some ways to this Canada Disability Benefit in that it is a federal benefit that is being paid in the event that you have become disabled. But for CPP disability, it requires you to have paid into this over a certain number of years. And so it's really only going to be a benefit for people who are or have been in the workforce for an extended period of time, which typically isn't going to be somebody who's in poverty. Not always, and I don't want to overly generalize here, but it's a different group that we're talking about. For CPP disability, if you're approved for CPP disability and you have access to long-term disability, your long-term disability insurer is in almost all cases going to be able to reduce the amount of money that they have to pay for the LTD benefit by however much you're getting your CPP disability. And it looks as though they're going to be able to do the same thing for the Canada Disability Benefit. They will be able to do the same thing unless the government steps in and clarifies this. And it's not something that the government is unaware of. This is an issue that many plaintiffs groups across the country, in Ontario, in BC and Alberta, groups that myself and others at my firm and others in the LTD industry have been a part of, have lobbied the government and said, this is a problem that you need to fix, and they haven't done it. So we'll see how this plays out. It's something that people should be aware of. Certainly when this is implemented, anybody who qualifies should be applying and getting that benefit, of course. But it is troubling that they haven't addressed either the taxability issue, and in my view, more importantly, the extent to which that benefit is going to be deductible from your long-term disability benefits.
Were you expecting more? Were people in general expecting more as far as the benefits concerned, or no? It was a little light.
Yeah, and that's not just because we're pulling numbers out of thin air. Mm-hmm. We certainly saw what was being proposed when this was being debated about, and when it was in committee, there were numbers that were discussed that were significantly higher. So, there are examples that were provided in order to allow the government to come up with different budgets to meet the need for funding the disability. And, I appreciate there's a lot of things that go into it.
Sure.
But the result is, I don't want to call it entirely toothless, but it really doesn't do a whole lot. I'm sure there are people that it will help, but really, if you're going to do this, it needs to go for it.
Let's get into some email here. By the way, you can send one along anytime. It might appear in a future show. James will collect those, and we'll throw them back out at you. Again, that's help@disabilityrights.ca. And the phone number, anyway, 1-855-821-5900. First up is Lucy. Says, hi, guys. I've been approved for my LTD, but with conditions. They said they are sending me for exercise therapy, but when the company got in contact, I was told it's a vocational therapist. They want me to do a career redirection or exploration and want to have me do a transferable skills analysis. I told the insurance company I'm willing to do the exercise therapy, but did not consent to the other stuff. I love my job and have been doing it for over 20 years. If I'm able to return to work eventually, I want to go back to my job, not be trained for another job that won't pay close to what I'm getting paid now. I just want to know if I have to consent to those other therapies to continue getting the LTD I'm on. What do you think, James? That's not nice.
It's a very interesting question, and it brings to light a particular issue with most standard long-term disability policies. So just to give this some context, I suspect that Lucy is coming up on the 2-year anniversary of when her LTD benefits were first approved. And so when that happens, at the 2-year mark, the test for whether you're entitled to benefits changes. First 2 years is whether you're disabled from your own occupation. Beyond 2 years is whether you're disabled from any occupation you're qualified for by training, education, or experience. And so at that 2-year mark, the insurance company will frequently, actively try to find ways to show that you are capable of doing some other occupation. And so these things that they're looking at, the career redirection or exploration, the transferable skills analysis, these are tools the insurer uses in order to determine and, frankly, to justify coming to the conclusion that you're capable of some other occupation. They're spending money on these things, and they do that because they believe that it's going to give them a sufficient justification to cut off your benefits. That is why they're doing it. It may not get them all the way there, but the question Lucy's asking is whether she has to participate in this, particularly because she likes her job. She wants to stay there. Mm-hmm. So here's the way this plays out. There's nothing that the insurer is asking for, at least in the context of what Lucy's told us in her email, that is out of bounds, that is inappropriate. And if the insurer is requesting that you submit to things that are appropriate within the context of the policy and you refuse to do it, you're giving them a justification for cutting off your benefits. And so then you have to take a look at what does that mean? Well, it doesn't mean that you have to go get another job. It doesn't mean that at the 2-year mark, if they say that you're capable of doing some other occupation, that you have to quit your job and go get the other job. What it does mean is if the insurer can show that, and sometimes they'll say they can, but that doesn't mean they're right. But let's assume just for the moment that they go through this process and there is, in fact, another occupation that Lucy is capable of doing that would pay her a commensurate income, which is about 60% of what she had been making before. In that scenario, Lucy doesn't have to quit her job and start doing the other occupation, but her insurance company would be justified in terminating benefits at that point in time. That's what the policy says. The insurance company is only required to pay those benefits if you meet the definition of disabled. And at the 2-year mark, it does become more difficult. You don't have to go to do the occupation they're saying, but if you don't, you won't be getting the benefits from the insurance company and they'll be justified. Now, submitting to those this transferable skills analysis and career redirection, that doesn't mean that the result is going to show that you're capable of another occupation, or even if it does, that the insurance company will be correct. There are ways to dispute that, but you do have to submit to those. Those are reasonable requests, and I would say that it is something that you should do if you want any chance of being able to continue to get benefits.
Well answered, my friend. Lucy, you want to reach out further beyond that email you just sent, which we appreciate, by the way. You can reach out to James and his team anytime, 1-855-821-5900, 1-855-821-5900. Lots more emails and questions on the way. We'll take a short break and get back into lots more of the Disability Law Show. Hang in there. All right, we're back at it. Disability Law Show. James Fireman is your guy. Reach out anytime, 1-855-821-5900 to do that, and email help@disabilityrights.ca. You know, I know you get this question quite often, James, when we're not doing this hour. That is, you know, if one of our listeners decides to hire a lawyer like you to sue the insurer, how long does it take to get a settlement? People are always in a hurry, or they just maybe don't know. Is it short? Depends, right?
Well, it depends on who you hire. There are different firms that operate on different timelines. We are generally thought of as being one of, if not the fastest turnaround firms in terms of getting a resolution. What our process is geared towards getting a resolution as early as possible without sacrificing the value of the claim, which is all well and good, and I'm sure everyone is saying that that's what they're doing. So what that timeline is for an LTD case is typically 10 to 12 months. The date you sign a retainer agreement, usually 10 to 12 months after that, we are at a mediation and the case resolves. There are situations where it can happen earlier and occasionally it will go longer, but I'm pretty careful in setting expectations for my clients. And I don't like my clients to ever think that I've told them something and not delivered on it. And so when I'm speaking to any new client on an LTD matter, unless there's something very unusual about the case, I will tell them your expectation should be 10 to 12 months from the date you sign the retainer. And I'm going to speak in a minute about why it is in that time frame and what goes on. There are certainly other firms that have a longer timeline. There are some that are operating that will take a full 2 years before they'll actually issue a claim. That's the extent of the limitation for bringing a lawsuit after you've been notified that your claim is denied or that your benefits have been terminated. I have no idea why anybody would wait the full 2 years unless there was a very specific unusual circumstance. The reality is the longer you take to get the process started, the longer it's going to take to get resolved. So that's the first thing. It's making sure that the claim is started right away. And so when we speak with the new client and they sign the retainer, we make sure that we get as much as we can from them out of the gate, including the denial letter. And that's typically going to be enough for us to start the claim. So in Ontario, you start a claim by issuing what's called a statement of claims, just a legal document. And if we have the denial letter, we usually have enough to at least get that process started. And as soon as we do that, we issue it in the court, we serve it on the insurance company, and then it's assigned to a lawyer. Now everything is up and running. It typically takes the insurance company a few weeks after that to get themselves in order, have it assigned to the particular lawyer, and the lawyer to respond. But once they do that, our process is to immediately then respond with a request for mediation at the earliest agreeable date. Now, there are some instances where the insurance company will agree to a mediation relatively soon thereafter. Relatively soon is still going to be 4 or 5 months at the minimum, because they're going to need to make sure that they get all the documentation and find a time when they're available, we're available, and when there's a mediator that both sides can agree to that's also available. So at a bare minimum, you're looking at 5 or 6 months, but that would be very, very quick for a mediated settlement. Typically, it's going to be 10 to 12 months before the insurance company responds and then agrees to a date that is acceptable to both parties. I often see it go longer, particularly when I've taken over files from other firms. But you know, that's a good expectation, is 10 to 12 months when you come to our firm. I won't speak for what others are going to do. It can resolve before mediation. That is something that does happen. I'd say probably happens maybe about 25% of the time. It shouldn't be your expectation that it's going to resolve before mediation, but it does happen. Where it happens is typically in a case where the amount of the settlement is reasonably well known. The amount that is available is reasonably well known. And that's usually going to be the case in a situation where either we're talking about somebody who is a lot closer to 65, because that's the maximum age it can go to. So, you know, someone in their late 50s or early 60s, where the future benefits is pretty limited, there's a possibility to get it done early there. Or somebody who was off for some extended period of time has come to us, we've started a claim, and then they've returned to work. And so we're dealing with just a set period of time that won't grow because of ongoing benefits. Those are situations where there can be an earlier resolution, but it's still unusual. And part of the reason for that is it's not something that I'm ever going to ask the insurer to do, particularly if it's somebody who is closer to 65. If someone's gone back to work, I'll let the insurer know. And usually that will lead to an early resolution. Somebody else, I'm not going to ask the insurer to negotiate before mediation, even though I want to get the case resolved as soon as I can. I'm not going to say to the insurer, hey, we have this mediation date, let's get this resolved before. And the reason I won't do that is because most insurers are going to interpret that in one of two ways. They'll either believe that my client is about to go back to work and is just looking to cash in, or they'll believe that my client is financially desperate and will take any settlement. Either way, you're destroying leverage. So it's not something I do. I'll ask for the mediation date to be as early as possible, but once we have that date, I'm not going to reach out and ask for an early resolution before that. The insurer sometimes will reach out, though, particularly if it's someone that I've dealt with in the past. I've dealt with most of the lawyers on the insurance side before and the claims handlers. They know me, they know our firm. And so oftentimes they'll know that it's something that we'll be able to deal with even without a mediation, if they believe it's something that is settleable before. And so in those circumstances, it can resolve sometimes in 5 or 6 months when they do reach out beforehand. But that's not what the expectation should be. The expectation should be around 10 to 12 months.
A very in-depth answer, pal. Appreciate that. I think we got time to get into Lee's email as well. Says, hi, I was terminated from my job of 14 years today, and I've been on LTD for roughly the last 7. My employer said my contract has been frustrated, and they're giving me 2 weeks severance and my vacation pay accrued. Is this legal? Wow.
This is definitely a question that got put into the rotation because we were expecting Tamar to sit in on this.
Right.
And Tamar, when we do the shows together, Tamar is usually the one that's going to handle any cases that have an employment element because she does do some of that work. I don't, but of course we have many lawyers at the firm that are practicing employment law. Now, having said that, even though I'm not myself an employment lawyer, I can tell you that if you've been on LTD for roughly 7 years, it wouldn't be unusual for the employer to be looking at frustration of contract. I don't want to get too specific and get out of my depth here on the employment side. And I would expect that Some of this would depend on the extent to which it's believed that you're going to continue to be disabled. But let's assume that that's the case, since you've been on LTD for 7 years already. Right. The question then is whether the 2 week severance in vacation pay is sufficient. And the answer is, I'm not entirely sure. I think some of it depends on whether your employer is federal versus provincial. And some of it depends on what the Employment Standard Act says. But typically speaking, when you're in a position that the employer is able to justify frustration of contract, when they're able to say that there's no reasonable prospect that you're going to return to work in the near future, or even the interim or the intermediate future, then they're going to be justified typically in taking the position that the contract's been frustrated, and that's going to significantly reduce the amount of severance down to those ESA minimums. What that is, I don't know for sure. That's usually what we would flip to Tamar, but in any case, it's something that we could certainly help out with. And that's, of course, the benefit of having a firm that deals with both LTD and employment. Even though I may not have the answer at the tip of my fingers, all it takes is a quick email to one of my partners on the employment side, and we can get that answer cleared up.
And with that, I'll send you off to that side as well, as James said, handling both, because sometimes they're in lockstep and the cases overlap. But to reach out to Tamar, or on that side of the firm, James, as you mentioned, 1-855-821-5900 is the way to do that. I should mention as well, mydisabilityquestions.com. Good website, free, anonymous, of course, searchable. So your question may be in there in the archive. It'll save you some time to search it up. If not, type it in like you would a normal email or any other question online, and it will get answered by James or a member of his team at the firm. First one we got from mydisabilityquestions.com. James, is this: I've been on LTD for 19 months. What happens up to or after 2 years?
So this is something I touched on in the last segment when we were talking about Lucy's email. And so what happens during the first 2 years after your benefits have been approved is your benefits are determined on the basis of whether you are disabled from your own occupation. Sometimes you'll hear us referring to the own occupation period. That's what we're talking about. Those first 2 years after benefits have been approved. And just to be clear, that's not usually going to be the first 2 years after you go on medical leave. In most long-term disability policies, there is an elimination period or qualifying period, they mean the same thing, during which you don't get long-term disability benefits. It's usually something like 3, 4, 6 months from the date that you go on leave, where you would have to show that you are continuously disabled before the benefits start being paid. So 3, 4, 6 months after you become disabled, your LTD benefits would kick in. From the point they kick in, over the next 2 years, typically, is going to be what we refer to as the own occupation period, where the test is whether or not you're disabled from your own occupation. Can you do the thing that you were doing before? And if not, is that because of a medical issue? As long as you're unable to do that, you're entitled to those benefits. After 2 years are up, or at least after the own occupation period is up, if it's not 2 years, the test will change. The test becomes, at that point, whether or not you're disabled from any occupation you're qualified for by training, education, or experience. And so oftentimes an insurance company that is approaching this two-year mark, this what we call the change of definition, when the test changes from the own occupation to the any occupation test, the insurance company will start doing things like a transferable skills analysis. They may ask you to go see a vocational expert. They may do some other things in order to determine whether or not there are other occupations that you're qualified for. And if there are, the insurer may well take the position that you're no longer entitled to benefits. Now, here's the catch. Even if there is some other occupation that you're capable of doing and that you're qualified for, so medically you're able to do it and you have the qualifications based on your training, your education, and your experience, even if that is the case, that doesn't necessarily mean that the insurer is going to be entitled to cut off your benefits, because they have to show that it's going to pay you a commensurate income. typically most policies don't define what a commensurate income is. And if your policy doesn't define it, then the courts have held that it's usually something in the range of about 60 to 65% of what you had been making before, often in line with what you're actually getting for your LTD benefits. Some policies will specify exactly what that is, and I've seen as low as 50%, some as high as 75%. But if the job that they identify or the occupation they identify doesn't pay you at least that commensurate income, then it won't count and your insurer will have to keep paying your benefits. So even if the insurer says there's some other occupation you can do, that's not the end of the analysis. And if they cut off your benefit because of it, please give us a call and we can take a look at whether or not it's justified. And if not, what we can do about it.
With that, we'll take a short break. James, got a few more minutes to go. More of your emails are coming up. You can send one along anytime. By the way, as you know, it's help at disabilityrights.ca and 1-855-821-5900. This is the Disability Law Show, and we're coming right back. All right, back. Disability Law Show. Beyond the hour of the show, James Fireman is your guy. He's got a great team with him. Call him. Have a chat. No problem. 1-855-821-5900. Help at disabilityrights.ca. Moving on down to Peter's email, says, James, I've seen you on TV many times and think you're awesome. I've been dealing with medical issues for over the past 6 months, noting my voice and ability to speak continues to deteriorate. I've had several doctor's appointments, MRI, CT scans, and a recent ENG study with a neuroscientist. He has set me up to have an intravenous treatment called IVIG, and then we'll determine further what the issue is. I know I can't go back to my job dealing with customers. My question is whether you think there's a risk that my LTD benefits will get cut off if I don't get a clear diagnosis for my vocal issues. Love this question.
It is a really interesting question. And first of all, I want to note that even though you started the email by saying, James, I've seen you on TV, I'm looking at it. It doesn't actually say, James, I've seen you on TV and think you're awesome. It just says, I've seen you on TV and think you're awesome. But I will choose to believe that Peter meant that to me and not to Tamar.
That's okay. Right.
in any case, moving on. The question is a really interesting question because we're dealing with a condition that may not be especially well understood. And so having a diagnosis seems like a really important thing. It is really important. I don't want to suggest that having a diagnosis is irrelevant. Certainly from a medical perspective, obviously having a diagnosis and then hopefully a better understanding of how to treat a condition is critical. But I'm not here to talk about the medical issues. From a legal perspective, particularly when we're talking about long-term disability, having a diagnosis, technically at least, is irrelevant. So if you take a look at a long-term disability policy, there's nothing in there that says you're only entitled to benefits if you have a diagnosis and the diagnosed condition prevents you from being able to do your own occupation after 2 years, any occupation. Diagnosis typically doesn't appear anywhere within a long-term disability policy. The focus when we're talking about LTD is not on the label that we give the medical condition. The focus is on what that condition does in terms of restricting or limiting function. And does it restrict or limit function in a way that prevents you from being able to do your job? So whether you have a diagnosis or what that diagnosis is doesn't technically matter when we're dealing with long-term disability. And the Supreme Court's been very clear about this. It is not an analysis of diagnosis. It's an analysis of function. And so you can have someone who has, let's say, cancer, but that is perfectly capable of continuing their job. And likewise, you can have someone with what otherwise might be a very benign condition. And, you know, the one I typically go to is a pinky finger that isn't working properly. That doesn't seem like something that would disable anybody from their job, but if you're a concert pianist, you can't do it anymore. And so the question is simply a matter of function. So getting to the particular question here, does having a diagnosis, is that going to be an issue without one? Well, yeah, from a technical standpoint, you don't need one. But from a practical standpoint, having a clear diagnosis is important. It does significantly help, particularly in being able to get your insurance company to approve your benefit without having to challenge them. So that's why I think a diagnosis can be really, really useful, because the claims handlers that are looking at these claims when they're coming in, when you apply for your benefits, the first thing they're going to do is they're going to look at the diagnosis and see whether or not the medical literature suggests that this is something that might well be disabling. And that's the first thing that they're going to look up. They'll go to WebMD or whatever service that they use. If they have an internal medical encyclopedia that they use, they'll look it up and see whether it's something that might result in a disability. That doesn't mean that it does, but that's where their analysis is going to go. And if there isn't a clear diagnosis, then it gives them an excuse to say, well, we don't see any disabling condition here. That is not a valid analysis, but it is the analysis a lot of insurance companies will do. So if you don't have a clear diagnosis, my expectation is most insurance companies are going to deny the claim out of the gate. That's typically right. The way that it goes. It's not 100% of the time, but that is what we see far more often than not. That is not a correct denial in and of itself. If you do have a medical condition, diagnosed or not, that's preventing you from working, you're entitled to benefits. And so if you're in that position and you don't have a clear diagnosis and you're not able to work because of your medical condition and your insurance company says, no, you're not entitled to benefits, that's something we can absolutely help with. And that's typically what an insurance company is going to do. We see this, by the way, with long COVID, for example.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there isn't a test for long COVID. There's a test for COVID, but whether or not the symptoms that frequently show up after a positive COVID diagnosis are long COVID or something else, there's no real way to determine that yet. I say yet because medical science develops over time. And you know, the hope is that at some point, hopefully in the near future, we're going to have a test where we'll be able to say conclusively whether somebody's symptoms are the result of long COVID. In any case, whether or not you have that clear diagnosis doesn't determine whether you're entitled to benefits. It may well determine how the insurance company deals with it out of the gate, but if they deny and you still have this ongoing condition, you should absolutely challenge them. So, you know, Peter, if you do get cut off without a clear diagnosis, that does not mean that you're not entitled to the benefits, not at all. As long as we can show that your condition is preventing you from being able to do your occupation, and you know, if you're not able to speak, that would seem to be a pretty clear indication of it.
Yeah.
Then, it's absolutely something that we can do if your insurance company does, in that situation, decide to cut you off.
Peter, really appreciate you reaching out. Great question for the week, by the way. And if you want to continue that conversation, make it a phone call to James as well, 1-855-821-5900. That always goes for you as well. If you're listening each week, we appreciate that. Always reach out with a phone call. Won't cost you anything. Just ask some questions and have a chat with James or his team. And that email address that Peter used, and you can as well. help@disabilityrights.ca. More to go. A few more minutes. We'll take a break and get right back to more of the Disability Law Show. You betcha. Back. Disability Law Show. A few minutes to go. Thank you for tuning in. And if you contribute to the show each week, we thank you again. And you can do that by emailing your questions, help@disabilityrights.ca. James next up is Beatrice says, hi there. I started a new job, but less than 3 months in, I was diagnosed with cancer, completely unforeseen and sudden. I was denied critical illness insurance that I had with my employer because if it was under 3 months, can anything be done about this? Thank you. What do you think, James?
Very interesting question. So first, I just want to give some context because we don't always talk about critical illness insurance. This is a different thing than long-term disability. So critical illness is insurance that's provided that pays out a set amount, a lump sum, in the event that you get a diagnosis that is specified in the policy. So this is quite different in many respects from LTD. LTD pays you a monthly benefit if you meet their test for disability. This pays you one lump sum if you have a specified diagnosis. And that's an interesting contrast given the discussion we had just before the break about a diagnosis not being required for long-term disability. For critical illness, it's the exact opposite. You do need a particular diagnosis, and it needs to be one of the diagnoses set out in the policy. Usually there are something like 14 or 15 different diagnoses, and there are all kinds of different qualifications for each one of those diagnoses, needless to say. But cancer typically is going to be a covered diagnosis, at least in some forms. And I'm presuming in this case, because Beatrice hasn't said otherwise, that the issue here isn't the form of the cancer. The issue here is the timing. And so on critical illness policies, similar to what happens on LTD policies, if you have a condition that existed before you became insured, then there may be a pre-existing exclusion that operates. In an LTD policy, that can only operate in the first year of coverage. So if you get onto a new LTD plan, typically when you start a new job, if it's a group plan, if you become disabled in the first year of coverage, then they're going to take a look at whether your disability is the result of something that you had before you became covered. Mm-hmm. And if so, you have to take a look at the language of the policy and see whether or not you're covered. Similar in critical illness. The one difference is critical illness policies, typically that pre-existing period during which they will take a look at whether it was a condition that existed beforehand, is usually 2 years for a critical illness policy. So this occurring within 3 months would certainly trigger an analysis of whether this was a pre-existing condition. And so then we have to take a look at the language that the policy uses. And I don't have the language of Beatrice's policy. She hasn't included it there.
Right.
But usually it's going to, especially for a critical illness policy, it's often going to be very broadly worded, the pre-existing exclusion, such that any condition that you had prior to coverage, whether or not it was diagnosed, will often be included within this pre-existing exclusion. I know I'm going back and forth, excluded, included. What that means essentially is if the insurance company is able to show that this is a condition that you had before you became covered, then it's likely going to be excluded from critical illness insurance payments because it came up in the first 2 years. The diagnosis was in the first 2 years. Certainly, if it's something that was diagnosed beforehand or even that you were getting treatment for or that you were seeking medical treatment for, that would almost certainly trigger the pre-existing exclusion. Whether or not any kind of treatment or symptoms were present beforehand is going, and whether, and the impact of that is going to depend on the language of the pre-existing exclusion. So in any case, you want to take a look at the policy. You want to make sure that you're looking directly at the language of the policy and what the insurance company is saying in their denial letter. So I'm making a lot of assumptions here about what's going on, but if it is the case that this is a denial on the basis of a pre-existing condition, I would expect it's going to be very difficult, unfortunately, for Beatrice to be able to fight this. Right. And the reason for that is simply because when you take a look at the, you know, I'm not a doctor, but it's very unlikely that Beatrice was did not have a cancerous condition at the time she became covered under the policy, if it was something that was diagnosed within 3 months of her coverage. And so yeah. I can't say for certain, but it seems pretty unlikely to me that scenario would play out.
Yeah, because she's only 3 months into the gig, right? That's pretty tight.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you know, perhaps if there's a doctor that is saying otherwise, then it's something that might be challengeable, but I doubt it.
Appreciate you reaching out, Beatrice. I want to move down to Carrie. Carrie's email says, I've been in LTD for over 5 years. I just read a section on my policy, which is about cost of living and the method for calculating changes to the Consumer Price Index, the CPI. I have the relevant pages of the policy, but it's not clear to me whether this means the insurer should have been adjusting my benefits by adding cost of living all along. I'm worried I haven't been paid properly.
Okay, so the cost of living adjustment, often we refer to it by the acronym COLA, cost of living adjustment, means exactly what Carrie's setting out here, that your insurance benefit, your long-term disability benefit, each year is going to go up based on the consumer price index. It's often a complex formula. Usually there's a maximum amount, even if the consumer price index goes above that, it can be capped out. Sometimes I've seen capped out at 2%. But it does at least allow you the ability to have those monthly benefits increase over time. That's certainly a helpful thing to have in your policy. Most don't have it. Sometimes, though, we do see policies that apply to different groups of employees. Often employees are grouped based on their job function, and there can be different provisions that apply to different employees. So it may be that the policy you're given has a COLA, cost of living adjustment, for some employees and not for others. And in that scenario, you may look at the policy, see this cost of living adjustment, and realize you haven't been getting it. That could be legitimate, but it might not be. And so if you're seeing that in the policy and you think that there's any chance that that might be something that's applicable to you, raise that with your insurer, raise that with your claims handler and say, I've looked at the policy, I see that there's a cost of living adjustment, and I don't believe I've been getting it. Can you please tell me why this is the case, and see what they say. If their answer doesn't satisfy you, if you're not completely certain that what they've said is correct and you still believe that you're entitled to that cost of living adjustment, don't leave it at that. Give us a call, and I'll be happy to take a look at it and see whether or not there's anything that we can challenge. And if so, then absolutely, we'll do something about it, and we'll make sure that you get the benefits you're entitled to.
Kerry, appreciate that. We are out of time. Thank you so much, everyone, for your contribution to the show every week, whether it's an email. And after this, you can always make it a phone call with James, too. But the email address we use every week, help@disabilityrights.ca. That website where you can also ask your questions freely and anonymously is mydisabilityquestions.com. And then finally, that phone number to reach out to James. Do it. Use it. Write it down. 1-855-821-5900. We'll catch you next time right here on the Disability Law Show.
The preceding was a paid commercial program. Unless otherwise identified, the guests on the program are employees of or otherwise represent the advertiser. The opinions expressed therein are those of the advertiser and do not necessarily reflect the views and policies of Corus Entertainment.